Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armodian. Scientists say we still have some time to address climate change, and we've made some headway, but we still have a long way to go. We rebroadcast a conversation we had with renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. And first, the United States has now passed the Inflation Reduction Act. Much of it addresses climate change, but does it meet the challenge that the planet faces with the changing climate? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On August 16th, 2022, President Joe Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law. Its name reflects the contemporary economic concerns in the United States, but in many ways, this is the Climate Change Response Act. After months of negotiations and what seemed to be a failure to pass legislation to address the U.S.'s commitment to the Paris Climate Accords, or what's called the nationally determined contributions, those are voluntary plans each nation pledges to meet the goal of trying to ensure the broad goal of keeping the planet under 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. This act now lays out a plan for the U.S. to contribute its part in slowing climate change. On today's show, we will explore what the U.S. will do and whether this plan seems to meet the challenge the planet faces, and in particular, the role the U.S. plays as the world's largest economy in facing the rising temperatures and climate change. Our guest today is Mark Jacobson. He is professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He is also the co-founder of the Solutions Project, 100.org, and the 100% Clean Renewable Energy Movement. He is the author of 100% Clean Renewable Energy and Storage for Everything, and has a forthcoming book, No Miracles Needed, How Today's Technology Can Save Our Climate and Clean Our Air, which is due out in December. Professor Jacobson, thank you very much for joining us. First, how is the U.S. approaching its climate change obligations in this so-called Inflation Reduction Act?
Well, first, thanks for having me on your show, Doug. The Inflation Reduction Act is a step toward addressing climate change, but it's maybe two steps forward and one step backward. Certainly, it's better than nothing because at least we are putting a lot of money into renewable energy and efficiency, electric vehicles, electric heat pumps, other types of electric appliances, and electricity production from clean renewable energy. And so those are the two steps forward, but the one step backwards is we're also subsidizing technologies that are not useful and that will continue allowing fossil fuels to persist, like carbon capture, blue hydrogen, which I should distinguish between what's blue hydrogen versus green hydrogen. Green hydrogen is hydrogen that's produced from electricity, where the electricity comes from wind or water or solar power, ideally. Blue hydrogen is hydrogen produced from natural gas, but then they try to add carbon capture equipment to capture the CO2. But this still allows lots of methane leaks from upstream to be emitted. Lots of the CO2 doesn't get captured, and it requires about 30% more energy than otherwise required. It requires more pipes. And in fact, you actually get more air pollution, even though there's some reduction of CO2. We want only green hydrogen in a future energy economy, and we only want to use hydrogen for certain applications. But the Inflation Reduction Act doesn't it will allow some of this blue hydrogen to persist. It'll allow carbon capture. So that'll allow both of those, allow fossil fuels to persist. You know, in the United States, 50,000 new oil and gas wells are drilled every year. And these will increase if we use carbon capture, because carbon capture increases the energy we need by about 30% to run the equipment. And then the other things that are going, also being subsidized that are not useful, are small modular nuclear reactors. I mean, there are hardly any new large nuclear reactors being built in the world today, only two reactors in the U.S., but they've been taking, in the U.S., they're on year 16 and 17 past the planning phase and still are not running, and have cost about $34 billion for these two reactors in Georgia. And that's about 17 times the capital cost of new wind or solar. and about seven times the energy, overall energy cost of new wind or solar. So it's pretty much a boondoggle. It takes forever to put up and cost a lot. Now, small modular reactors, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, we tried small modular reactors, but we went bigger because of economies of scale. Now we're going back to smaller ones that won't even be ready, according to the people who are trying to develop them, until maybe 2029 or 2030 for prototypes. Again, we need to solve 80% of the climate problem by 2030. And so when we have technologies that won't even be available, prototypes won't even be available till about then, and actual operating versions won't be available until years later, it's just not helpful at all. And there's no evidence that it won't be more expensive, that it won't take longer. It'll still have weapons proliferation issues, in fact, more, because these are smaller, you can move them around the world, and more meltdown risk still, and uranium mining issues and waste issues. So that's a waste to spend money on small modular reactors. Carbon capture, bioenergy is another thing that's not a useful application of funds, because there you still burn the bioenergy to produce air pollution. We're trying to eliminate air pollution. There's a lot of energy needs to go into bioenergy and production. So there's not really saving that much in terms of carbon either. Uses lots of land in most cases. Anyway, so these are things that are just not useful, that there's a lot of money being spent, but you know, there is a lot of money is being spent on some good things too.
You mentioned nuclear power. I know a number of advocates for nuclear power have suggested this is the way to address climate change, since, I mean, the one thing nuclear power has is environmental challenges, but it doesn't contribute to greenhouse gases. Do we have enough technology and enough energy to be able to meet the growing energy needs in a renewable way that doesn't contribute to climate change and doesn't involve nuclear?
Oh, yes. It's much easier to address climate change and air pollution worldwide with renewable energy than with nuclear power. Just to put things in perspective, I mean, there are around 400 nuclear reactors in the world today, and the nuclear energy output today is less than in 2006. So nuclear has not been growing at all in the last 16 years. And there's more plants retiring than are being built. And this is just going to go on forever. There might be some small increments of increases here and there. But if we have 400, if we wanted to power the world with nuclear power for everything, we need about 16,000 reactors, which will never even come close to happening. Even if we double the number of reactors from 400 to 800, that's only going to be about 5% of the world's energy. So right now, you know, for all purposes, that is, that we need. So there's no chance. And the fact that we have all these side issues with nuclear, like weapons proliferation, multiple countries have developed nuclear weapons secretly under the guise of civilian nuclear energy programs. We have waste issues. We have to store waste for like several hundred thousand years, and that takes a lot of energy, and we need storage facilities. Right now, waste is just piling up at each reactor site in many places, most places. We have meltdown risk. 1.5% of all nuclear reactors ever built have melted down to some degree. We have underground uranium mining, lung cancer risk. There's all sorts of problems, aside from the fact that the cost is so high and it takes so long to put up new nuclear reactors, to plan and operate them. It's right now, it's between 15 and 21 years. So it's just not a solution at all in any way, shape, or form to the climate problem. Is just a swimming pool of money going down the drain when we put money into nuclear, because we need solutions that we can implement within 1 to 3 years. And that means solar, wind, and batteries, and electric vehicles, electric heat pumps, efficiency, things that are obvious we should be investing all our money on, and keeping our eye on the ball and not get distracted with solutions that really have no chance of helping us solve these problems in the future.
And you've described what Congress just passed, what the president just signed, as two steps forward, one step back, perhaps. Now, the two steps forward, my understanding is a lot of the provisions that are meant to address climate change are just a series of tax credits to compel industry individuals to make greener choices. Is that an accurate way to describe what they just
passed. Yes, and that part's good in, for most things. Like, for example, there's a $7,500 tax credit for electric vehicles, and there are, I think, 17 brands of electric vehicles or 17 models in the U.S., for example, that apply, you can apply the $7,500 for. And, you know, and also for electric heat pumps, there's a credit for energy efficiency improvements, for an electric induction cooktop stove to get rid of your gas stove. So there's a lot designed to help people eliminate natural gas in their home if they have natural gas, because that's what there are four main sectors of energy. There's electricity, transportation, buildings, and industry. And buildings where people live and work. And if you individuals can actually transition their own homes. If you have an existing home, you can retrofit it. If you have a natural gas air heater or water heater, you can replace either one with a heat pump air heater, which also runs in reverse as an air conditioner, and or a heat pump water heater. And if you have a gas dryer, you can replace it with a heat pump dryer. Heat pumps use 1/4 the energy as natural gas, so save a huge amount of money in the long run, even if the initial investment is a little bit more, which is not necessarily. And so you can just go through your home. You can change your gas stove with an electric induction cooktop stove. So you can do that with existing buildings, and especially with new buildings. All new buildings should be just built from scratch without natural gas. There's no reason to have two forms of energy in your home. There's no reason to have both gas pipes and electric wires in your home. Everything can run on electricity more efficiently than with gas. I built a home back in 2017, or finished in 2017, and it has no gas on the property. I have electric cars, electric heat pumps, induction cooktops, LED lights, triple pane windows. It's very efficient. I have solar on my roof and batteries in the garage. I haven't paid an electricity bill in 5.5 years. I haven't paid a natural gas bill in 5.5 years. I haven't paid a gasoline bill in 5.5 years. And I produce 20% more electricity than I consume, averaged over those 5.5 years. And I sell the extra electricity back to the grid, making about $800 a year for that. The whole system with the tax credits that have been available has already paid itself off. After 5 years, the solar and battery system, for example, paid itself off completely. Without subsidies, it would take about 10 years, but solar is warranted for 25 years. So it's a no-brainer to try to electrify your home as much as possible. Even though there's an investment up front, it definitely saves over time tremendous amounts of money. And especially, as you can see, both gasoline prices and natural gas prices are very volatile and have skyrocketed recently. Now they've come down a little bit, but they're still high. And you eliminate or severely reduce that volatility by, one, producing your own power. But even if you don't produce your own electricity, let's say from solar, it's still the electricity prices can be more stable if we transition all energy in each state and country to 100% renewables. And because there are multiple ways to keep the grid stable, it's a lot easier with renewable energy systems plus storage and plus transmission, distribution, and demand response than it is with conventional fuels.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the U.S.'s recent legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the impact it's going to have on the U.S.'s response to climate change with Mark Jacobson of Stanford University. Now, a lot of what the Inflation Reduction Act is meant to do is give these kind of positive inducements, tax credits to try to make these transitions. But I know that there have been movements as well that might be a bit more sort of a negative inducement or actually outlawing certain types of practices. For example, what comes to mind is California, state we're both in right now, just passed legislation, my understanding, or I don't know if it's a gun reject, to try to ensure that there are no new gas-powered vehicles, and I believe by 2035. Is this the future where you get both the tax credits to go electric, but eventually one of the big reasons to go electric is you're just not going to be able to resell a gas car after a certain year?
Yeah, well, it's certainly good to phase out gasoline and diesel passenger cars and trucks and buses and everything else that for transportation in favor of electric, and then in some cases, hydrogen fuel cell for long distance heavy transport, like long distance aircraft and ships. Because, I mean, an electric passenger car uses 1/4 the energy as a gasoline car. So it's to your benefit to do that. For example, you know, the equivalent cost of driving an electric car when you're powering it with solar from your roof is about 80 cents a gallon equivalent versus anywhere from $4 to $7 or $8 a gallon for gasoline. So, you know, if you're driving 15,000 miles per year for 15 years, and, you know, if the price of gasoline on average were $6 a gallon, then you'd be saving about $30,000 over that period. If it's $4, it's, you're saving closer to $20,000, but it's a lot of money that you're saving, even if the car is more expensive. But now you have this tax credit from the Inflation Reduction Act of $7,500 that pretty much evens out the price of, or makes it even cheaper for some electric cars versus gasoline equivalents. But we want to do this not only because it saves money, but because it saves our health and our children's health. Because, you know, the biggest source of air pollution, mortality, and morbidity is exhaust from vehicles. Because that's where people breathe in the exhaust. They're closer to the exhaust than other sources of pollution, most other sources of pollution, especially if they're commuting a lot. And so this has a big health benefit, so a big public health benefit, which has a public health benefit cost benefit as well. And it also eliminates carbon dioxide and other chemicals that cause planetary warming. So there's multiple benefits for going to electric vehicles. And anything we can do to phase them out as fast as possible, like mandates that by a certain year, we're going to have only new electric vehicles on the road. But I can only say we need to do this faster. 2035 is too slow, and there's no reason. We already have 17 models of electric vehicles, at least 17 in the US, and there's no reason, you know, we shouldn't increase that transition pace.
And by the way, a number of European countries do in fact have earlier phases. I think, for instance, France was going to phase it out by 2028, if I remember correctly. There was one country, was it Italy, that was talking about phasing out by 2026. So the US is in some cases 8 to 10 years behind even their European partners.
And these targets may change. So we, you know, in California and other states, that phase out date might come faster because what we see is generally as people start adopting more and the price comes down, then there's less resistance actually to changing. And we've seen this historically. So I'm pretty sure that will happen. You know, so that 2035 date, even for California, may be moved up within a couple of years even.
And I know in 2005, we generally perceived that we had hit a version of peak oil and gas prices skyrocketed, and we saw an increase in hybrid vehicles. I guess one of the big tensions I had, and let me get your thoughts on this, is politically speaking, there's probably no development that has hurt President Biden more than the increase, you know, of gas prices. And so he's doing everything he possibly can to try to decrease those gas prices. That relationship, though, between rising gas prices, which really has a lot to do with questions of supply and versions of peak oil than it does any sort of government policy, seems to suggest, I mean, there's a tension here. I guess part of it is I'd never want to run for public office on this, but high gas prices are not a bad thing for climate change, right?
Well, for transitioning to renewables, they're essential if we want to speed things up. And if you think about it, like the higher gas prices are, the more people switch to electric cars. And so that relieves a lot of the demand for gasoline. And so the gasoline price should then drop, you know, after people purchase enough electric cars. Now, if he really wants to reduce gasoline prices, ironically, the best thing is to promote electric vehicles. And that will not only help the people who are buying the electric vehicles, but eventually it'll result in some lower gasoline prices. But we want to phase out gasoline as fast as possible. There's no doubt about it. And the more we can encourage electric transportation, the easier it is for people to accept that. And even, you know, the more we can help, the government can help. I mean, so instead of spending money on carbon capture, nuclear power, bioenergy, if we put more of that money into electric transportation, shifting to electric transportation faster, I mean, it's just so much better in every respect for health, for climate, and for people's pocketbooks. So this is why this Inflation Reduction Act is two steps forward, one step back. It's because third of the money that's been wasted on these technologies are not going to help anything. It could easily be spent on much more useful endeavors to reduce air pollution, climate impacts, and save people money.
Yeah, and one of those endeavors then would be research into new renewables. Now, I know you've advocated that we actually probably have the technology now to meet energy needs. Before we get to that, where are the areas that seem to be potentially most fruitful for new advancements in renewables? If you were to put money in research in some of these new renewables, where do you think we should focus on?
Well, we have around 95% of the technologies we need. The things we don't have are like long-distance aircraft running on hydrogen fuel cells, long-distance ships running on hydrogen fuel cells. We actually now have long-distance trains running on hydrogen fuel cells, and we have a steel factory running on hydrogen, but green hydrogen. So those are some of the things that need improvement, like so long-distance ships and aircraft and some industrial processes. But, then we can always improve, like floating offshore wind farms. We do have floating offshore wind farms now, but that can be made more efficient to get the cost of offshore wind down. The cost of onshore wind is the cheapest form of electricity in the world. Well, combined with depending on where you are compared with solar, solar is also could be considered the cheapest in some places. But offshore wind is more expensive. So trying to reduce the cost of offshore wind really can change the game. Reducing the cost of batteries even more, that's critical, because once the cost of batteries gets to $50 a kilowatt hour of storage, then the game is pretty much over and we can keep the grid stable everywhere with low cost batteries. So those, you know, some types of storage, but really just converting. I mean, a lot of money doesn't need to go into research. It really needs to go into implementation, deployment, deploy, deploy, deploy. That's really what we need to do, is we need to go into people's homes, get rid of the gas pipes, you know, change them with wires so that we electrify homes. Get rid of gasoline cars, get rid of gasoline lawnmowers, leaf blowers, everything that where you're burning things. That's the key, is to eliminate combustion as a source of energy and, you know, substitute it for electrification.
Now, you mentioned batteries and battery storage. I know that's always been a huge challenge for solar, is being able to provide enough storage so that we know that we can heat our homes and run our appliances when the sun isn't shining. What's the status of solar battery storage?
Well, battery prices continue to decline for the most part. I mean, they do go up sometimes, but they're mostly coming down. And there are many different types of batteries. And there are systems, large systems of batteries that have been deployed in parts of the world, in South Australia and California, but many other places in the world, there are big battery systems that are keeping the grid stable. In fact, in California, I mean, I think it's on the order of a couple percent of the grid can stay up for a while just due to batteries, and which is much bigger, much higher penetration than even like 2 years ago. It's just been skyrocketing, and the amount of batteries has been added to California's grid. We do need a lot more, and as the price comes down, that will help to do that. There are other types of storage besides your typical batteries that for electricity. There's pumped hydro storage, there's plain hydroelectric power. Of course, that's, you know, being challenged right now because of all the droughts. But there are also what are called gravitational storage through gravitational masses, where you have, when you have extra electricity, use it to pick up a concrete block. When you need electricity, you lower the concrete block. So it's really straightforward. It's like pumped hydro. When you have extra electricity, you push water up a hill. When you need it, you let the water flow down the hill. There's also what are called flywheels for short-term intense storage. But, you know, when we electrify other energy sectors like heating and transportation, we actually make it easier to match power demand with supply on the grid, and we need less electricity. We need more overall electricity, but we need less energy overall. I mean, electrifying everything, it turns out, reduces total energy demand by on the order of 56% worldwide due to the efficiency of electric vehicles, of electric heat pumps, electric industry. So we need less energy, but all the remaining energy will be electric. So we have maybe twice as much electricity on the grid, but 56% less overall energy. But it makes it easier when you have electric demands, like battery electric vehicles, where you have batteries stored in cars. You don't need to attach a wind turbine to a car to run it. You have batteries, so you can charge the car any time of day or night. So that makes it easier to balance demands on the grid. Same with a heat pump water heater. You can charge that heat pump water heater, the heat. You can create the heat like when the electricity price is low, maybe at night or sometime during the day when the electricity price is low. So you can manage demand on the grid, and that helps to keep the grid stable when you have what are called these flexible loads, like water heating and electric vehicles. But it turns out there are a lot of flexible loads that you get by electrifying all the energy sector.
And so last question for you then is, Congress passes this legislation, the president signs the legislation, and seemingly the U.S. is addressing climate change at least more seriously than even if we'd held this discussion a month ago, because it seemed to come out of there. How much does the Inflation Reduction Act actually meet the challenge? And how much more aggressive does the U.S. need to be in trying to address its contributions to the greenhouse effect, its contributions to climate change?
Well, I mean, this is a stepping stone. So yeah, we need a lot more. I mean, let's put it in perspective. I mean, the Inflation Reduction Act, I think it was like $370 billion. I mean, if we want to transition the entire U.S. for all purposes to clean, renewable energy, electricity, transportation, buildings, and industry, that's going to require on the order of $8 trillion. And of the $370 billion, I don't know the exact numbers, but let's say half of it is actually for useful things. The rest is kind of pork and for things that technologies are not so useful. So we're talking maybe, less than a couple hundred billion versus $8 trillion that we need to transition all energy. However, I should point out that when we transition all energy, it's not going to be due to all subsidies from the government. It's going to just be due to investments, and then you get the money back through electricity sales over time. So if somebody buys builds a wind farm, they're going to find investors to invest in that wind farm, and they'll sell the electricity and they'll get the money back over time. So it's really that investment that we're counting in the $8 trillion. So we need that type. We need $8 trillion of investment. So this, let's say $200 billion is helpful because it's not even investment. It's kind of extra, and it really spurs people to do more. But we're far, far away from transitioning. I mean, in the U.S., of the electricity sector, about a little over 20% is now renewable, clean renewable energy, wind, water, and solar. I think it's like 22% even or so. But electricity is only 20% of all the end use energy. So we're at 20% of 20%. So that's a 4%, but we're actually maybe a little higher. But as I mentioned, if we electrify all the other energy sectors, our energy demand goes down significantly.
Well, thank you very much, for these insights. Our guest today has been Mark Jacobson. He's professor of civil and environmental engineering and the director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He's also the co-founder of the Solutions Project, 100.org, and the 100% Clean Renewable Energy Movement. He's the author of 100% Clean Renewable Energy and Storage for Everything, and has a forthcoming book, No Miracles Needed, How Today's Technology Can Save Our Climate and Clean Our Air, which is due out in December of this year. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Doug.
When we come back, we speak with renowned climate scientist Michael Mann. Stay tuned. This interview is recorded in September 2016. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next guest is a renowned climate scientist who can tell us both about the science and the policies. He's also lived the rough and tumble life of politics and wrote about it in his new book, The Madhouse Effect. Dr. Michael Mann hasn't lost hope that we can still address climate change before it's too late, though he acknowledges that the changes have already begun. Professor Michael Mann is a climatologist and geophysicist, and he's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Dr. Mann was one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and has written a book called The Madhouse Effect. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Dr. Michael Mann. It's great to have you back here with us again.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
You have this new book to address the general public, but you have also done a lot of the climate science yourself. You had said that the tools that you and other climate scientists had developed are increasingly unnecessary, maybe because we can actually see the real effects of climate change now. How would you describe the effects that we can actually see right now?
What I was saying was when it comes to actually seeing the impacts of climate change, the impacts are no longer subtle, and it's no longer necessary to try to tease the signal out of the noise of natural climate variability in the way we would have had to do in the past, because the signal has become so large that we can actually see it with our very own two eyes. And the last year, of course, has been a record year where the oceans have been warmer than they've ever been before. And so what that means is that warmer oceans evaporate more moisture into the atmosphere. There's more moisture available to turn into record rainfall events. And so the fact that we've seen, I think, a half dozen thousand-year rainfall events, and what do we mean? When we say a thousand-year rainfall event, we mean, based on the normal statistics of weather, that event shouldn't happen more often than once in a thousand years. And just over the last year, we probably had about a half dozen of those thousand-year rainfall events, not just Louisiana, but Texas, in Arizona, in South Carolina, in West Virginia. And so what we're seeing in these very large increase in the number of extreme weather events, we're seeing the loading of the weather dice. We're seeing the sort of random dice of weather have been loaded by climate change towards these more extreme events. And, you know, that flooding is just part of it. We've seen record wildfires and unprecedented drought in California. We are seeing the impacts of climate change play out now in real time.
As I had understood this just from reading the layperson literature, is that you can't really identify one or two of these events and say, well, this is definitely a result of climate change, but collectively they are related to climate change.
It's somewhere in between the two statements, really. That's partly true, but it's not the whole story. And in fact, in our new book, in The Madhouse Effect, Tom Tolles and I include a cartoon that actually deals with this question of, you know, whether you can or not you can blame extreme weather events on climate change. And there's a little footnote in the cartoon, as there always are in Tom's cartoons. Many of your listeners will be familiar with this cartoon on the pages of the Washington Post, the square cartoons. And there's a little guy down in the corner, which is actually Tom himself, who's usually saying something pithy, something you want to read, the small print. And the small print of that one, it's a loophole you could lose a planet through. And what we mean there is it's sort of a loophole to be able to say, well, you know, you can never blame any one weather event on climate change. It's tantamount to saying you can never blame any one death from lung cancer on smoking of cigarettes. Even though we know many people died from lung cancer because they smoked cigarettes, it could have happened naturally. So if you're talking about any one individual, there's always the possibility that it could have happened naturally. And in fact, that gave rise to a concept called fractional attribution, which is now used in climate change as well. It was used in the legal settlements with the tobacco industry that, you know, basically that some percentage of people who died from lung cancer we know was caused by your product, and you have a liability that's associated with that. So even though it's a statistical connection, real people, actual people did die from lung cancer caused by smoking cigarettes, and actual weather events have been made worse in many different ways by the effects of climate change. And so when somebody says something like, well, you can't prove it was caused by climate change, it really is. It's a technicality.
One of the things that seemed interesting to me over all of this is that the changes seem to have happened much faster than we were originally thinking they would happen. Is that true?
In many respects, it is true. And it really gets at a very important point. You know, the critics, those who favor an agenda of inaction, of not doing anything about the problem, will say, well, there's uncertainty in the science. And as long as there's uncertainty, we don't know for sure that you know, the burning of fossil fuels is a problem, so we shouldn't take action. Well, that's not true. But even the very premise behind that sort of reasoning is wrong, because uncertainty cuts both ways. And yeah, maybe you can get lucky, and the uncertainties might cut in the direction of some of the impacts not being as bad as we predicted. But the history of the science seems to suggest the other possibility. In many respects, the changes have taken place faster than we predicted. The uncertainty appears to be cutting against us, not in our favor when it comes to the impacts of climate change. And that's true with the loss of Arctic sea ice. We're losing Arctic sea ice. The Arctic is sort of our refrigerator. And as we lose that sea ice, that impacts the entire planet in an adverse way. And the models have tended to predict that we shouldn't see the disappearance of sea ice in the late summer. We just, by the way, tied the second lowest sea ice level at the end of this summer. And so we're near record lows, and we're already well outside of the range of what the models predicted. The models predicted we shouldn't see a total disappearance of Arctic sea ice until the end of this century. If you extrapolate the trajectory we're on, scientists expect that within maybe a decade or two, we will see ice-free conditions in the Arctic. We also know that the ice sheets, the continental ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet, the West Antarctic ice sheet, losing ice well ahead of schedule. The models predicted that they shouldn't start, those ice sheets shouldn't start to disintegrate until the middle of this century. And in part, that's because some of the models actually have more snow accumulation taking place in the center of the ice sheet, where the atmosphere is actually slightly warmer. There's more moisture, so you get more snowfall in the interior of the ice sheet, and that offsets the melting that's taking place at the periphery of the ice sheet, where it meets the ocean, for example. Well, it turns out that that's not what's happening. We are losing ice at the periphery much faster than there's any replacement in the center of the ice sheets, and so we're losing ice from the continental ice sheets decades ahead of schedule. That means that we are seeing an increase in sea level rise from the melting of that ice that, again, is well ahead of schedule. So the sea level rise problem is worse than we expected based on the predictions that were made, you know, just a decade ago. And there are many other examples where the changes and the impacts are playing out faster and worse than what we had predicted.
And I imagine that the ecosystems themselves, both in the oceans and of land, are the most severely affected, which then has the ongoing influence on our food and water and that sort of a thing. Can you just give us a thumbnail absolutely. Sketch of what we've seen so far?
That's absolutely right. And one of the problems is that when you start looking at impacts on, you know, ecosystems, on species, on food webs, there's something, you know, a term we use in science, nonlinear. It means that there are very complex interactions between, you know, living things and each other and their environment. And there's the potential that a small change in the external conditions can lead to a very large change in the behavior of that system. Tipping points, collapse. You can have the collapse of ecosystems, where a small change in climate upsets the balance such that you really get a far more abrupt and profound impact on the environment, on species, animal species. Coral reefs is a very good example. They are under threat right now from multiple insults caused by human activity, climate change being one of them, warming of oceans, coral bleaching imperils coral reefs. But the increasing CO2 in the atmosphere is making the oceans more acid, and that's literally starting to dissolve the coral reefs. And then you add the pollutions, the pollutants that make it out into our oceans, and they're being hit by all of these simultaneous insults. And again, it's the so-called nonlinearity. When you have a system, when you have a living thing, and we know this in our own lives, you know, when one bad thing happens to you, you can deal with it. When a couple bad things happen to you, you know, it's a little hard to deal with. When three or four different things start going badly in your life, all of a sudden you feel like your entire world is collapsing. And that's because we react poorly, and all living things react poorly to multiple simultaneous insults. And that's what we're doing to our ecosystems right now. And it's a cause for worry. We are subjecting them to changes that they have not experienced in the entire history of their existence. And we're doing that in multiple ways. We're hitting them with multiple insults.
One of the things that you addressed in this new book of yours is your detractors, as you called them here, and they had been very vocal historically with the denial and the argument that there wasn't enough certainty in the science to move policy forward. It seems like, though, they have been quieter lately. Would you say that's true?
I think that is true to some extent. I think that climate change denialism is becoming somewhat marginalized, at least in our mainstream public discourse. Now, there's some important provisos there. You know, climate change denial is still expressed at the very highest levels of our politics right now. But I do think that climate change denial is less welcome in polite conversation now. And I think that's in part due to people can see that something's happening. It's no longer subtle. It makes it very difficult for you to tell them that it's not happening. And I think that's really one of the critical developments here.
In this new book of yours, you said that we can still avoid the catastrophes, maybe even reverse some of it. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. You know, the reality is that there is no one threshold. I can't give you a precise amount of warming of the globe and promise you that if we keep warming below that, bad things won't happen. Let's face it. There are some bad things that we already see happening just from the climate change that's already taken place. So it's a matter of how far we're willing to go down this dangerous road. And, you know, the experts who have looked at the impacts of climate change have determined that once you go beyond about 2 degrees Celsius warming of the planet relative to the pre-industrial time, it's 3.5 Fahrenheit warming, and we're already about halfway there. We've already warmed the planet a degree Celsius. We maybe have another half a degree Celsius in the pipeline, and so we only have a small amount of wiggle room if we're going to avoid crossing that dangerous 2 degrees Celsius limit. We can still do it. If you just look at the numbers, if you crunch the math, it is possible for us to bring our emissions down at a rate of several percent a year in the decades ahead, such that we avoid crossing that sort of 2 degrees Celsius warming range where we really do start to see the worst impacts of climate change. So if we act now, we can avert a catastrophe, and we are seeing some progress already due to the amazing sort of developments in renewable energy technology, the dramatic increases in the market share of renewable energy, and even here in the U.S., where we have seen a dramatic increase in wind and solar power, in electric vehicles. We're starting to turn the corner. Last year, the numbers came in and told us that carbon emissions, for the first time on record globally, actually went down. And that's a direct response to the efforts, you know, among many of the nations of the world to try to stem the tide and do something about the problem and transition towards renewable energy. So we're starting to turn the corner. The problem is we need to turn the corner even faster if we are going to avoid crossing that dangerous threshold of warming. And so we got an important start in the process in Paris last December, where nearly 200 nations around the world, including the world's top emitters of carbon, agreed to make substantial reductions, enough to cut the warming roughly in half from where we would be going under business as usual emissions, basically getting us halfway to what we need to do to keep the warming below 2 degrees Celsius. So we're starting to go down the right path, but we're going to have to do a lot more if we're going to avert catastrophic impacts on our planet.
Is there any way for you to be able to explain, like in specific terms, like how much would we need to do, change our energy by X percent, yeah, or change our driving habits by Y percent, or anything like that, or our eating habits?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do on a voluntary basis that cut our carbon emissions, decreases our personal carbon footprint, and we ought to be doing them anyways, because what we call no regrets actions, like bicycling to work when we can rather than driving to work. Well, it saves us money. It makes us healthier, more efficient appliances. There are all these things that we can do that cut our carbon emissions and make us healthier and happier and save us money, and we ought to be doing those things anyways. In fact, we call them negative costs, because actually there's a benefit immediately to doing it. Voluntary actions alone don't get us as far as we need to go if we are going to avoid that dangerous level of warming. If you talk to economists, they'll tell you that to really solve this problem, we need to put a price on carbon. Producers of fossil fuel energy and power have to pay for the damage that their product is doing to our planet through some sort of mechanism. It can be a carbon tax. It could be some sort of cap and trade system. But one way or another, we need to put a cost on the burning of fossil fuels so we level the energy marketplace so that renewable energy, which isn't degrading our planet in the same way, can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy, which has this cost that isn't currently represented in the marketplace. There isn't a price signal right now for the damage that fossil fuel energy is doing to the planet. And until you put a price on the burning of carbon, you really don't have the incentive system necessary to steer us in the direction we need to go.
What I was getting at was getting a sense of how much we need to alter either the energy use or the, I know farming is also another big source of emissions. And so I guess I was trying to get a sense of how much we would need to shift in order to avert going down a disastrous path.
We have to bring our carbon emissions down by about 5% a year over the next several decades if we're going to avoid raising CO2 levels to where we get that 2 degrees Celsius or more warming of the planet. And so we obviously need policies that achieve those sorts of reductions. Now, some of those policy changes are almost invisible to us. If you have a carbon tax, like I said, then all of a sudden, then energy producers will increase the percentage of their portfolio that is from renewable sources, from wind, from solar, from geothermal. So, the energy that you're getting comes increasingly from renewable sources. And so we might end up paying a little bit more for energy as we go through that transition. But it really is almost imperceptible, the impact that it actually has on our lives. So some people think that we have to fundamentally change our lifestyles to deal with this problem. That isn't necessarily true. We have existing technology right now that if we scale it up at the rate that we could potentially scale it up, and there are peer-reviewed scientific studies that show this, that we could meet nearly 100% of our projected energy needs from renewable energy, from renewable sources alone, within a matter of a couple of decades. We can do that. We have the technology to do it. We just need the policy incentives to move us in that direction. And to us, in the way that we lead our daily lives, it doesn't necessarily need to lead to any dramatic change in our lifestyles. That having been said, sure, there are things that we can do, changes in our lifestyle, that if we make them voluntarily, they definitely will help out the problem. But no, we do not have to dramatically change our lifestyles to solve this problem. We just need to favor policies that will incentivize the market to move in the direction that it needs to go for us to basically wean ourselves off fossil fuels.
I think you said 5% change is what we would actually need in terms of emissions?
5% reduction a year in the carbon emissions.
Okay.
And right now, I mean, renewable energy is almost growing at a rate that will achieve that as long as we incentivize those renewable energy sources.
So the solar and the wind are growing at a rate that can almost get us there. And so you're thinking perhaps we can meet that 5% by just a little bit of tweaking.
Yeah, let me give you an example. So we sometimes talk about market parity or grid parity. When renewable energy becomes as or less expensive than fossil fuel energy. And right now we're on a trajectory where that will be true probably in a matter of 5 to 10 years. If we did nothing other than just let the renewable energy providers do what they're doing, we soon enough would be at the point where it would be cheaper to go with renewable energy anyways. Now, the problem is that we don't have 5 to 10 years to wait if we're going to decrease our carbon emissions so that we avoid warming the planet more than 2 degrees Celsius. And that means that you do need extra market incentives that help steer us in the direction that we're starting to go anyway. So it's sort of like you're just sort of accelerating the natural process that's already underway, where we are moving away from fossil fuel energy towards renewable energy. In a matter of years, renewable energy will outcompete fossil fuel energy even without a price on carbon. But we need a price on carbon to get us there even sooner.
When these policy discussions occur, do you still have a sense that the fossil fuel industry are fighting on the other side to prevent the renewable energies from coming online in such a powerful way? Or do you have a sense that they're going to perhaps maybe even buy into the renewable energies in order to stay viable companies?
Yeah, I think the enlightened companies, and we're already seeing that, are going to invest a larger and larger amount of their portfolio in renewable sources. I mean, that is the direction that the global economy is going. China recognizes that. They are outspending us. They are investing far more in renewable energy. They're moving towards, in fact, they have invested so much in solar cell technology that their products have flooded the global market and led to a sharp decrease in the cost of solar panels. So the research and development that they've done has benefited the entire world with cheaper solar panels. So that's the direction that the global economy is headed. And those countries that get on board are going to be out ahead on this. And those countries that continue to rely on fossil fuels for energy are going to fall behind the rest of the world in terms of their global competitiveness. And so, you know, that is the direction that things are going anyways. And if we, don't move in that direction, then we fall behind the rest of the world.
And I can't let you leave our radio program without explaining the hockey stick.
Sure thing. So back in the late 1990s, my co-authors and I engaged in a scientific analysis where we attempted to extend the record of global temperatures back in time, because we only have about a century and a half of widespread thermometer measurements around the globe, and that allows us to construct a curve that shows how temperatures have changed over the last 150 years. And that curve shows that the globe has warmed and it continues to warm. In fact, the last year was the warmest year on record. But what the instrumental data alone can't tell us is how unusual that sort of warming might be in a longer-term context. And so back in the late 1990s, to try to create that longer-term context, we did an analysis where we made use of what we call proxy data, like tree rings and corals and ice cores and sediments, to reconstruct how the climate had changed in the more distant past. And that led to a curve that depicted our estimate of how temperatures had changed over the last 1,000 years. And that curve showed relatively modest changes from 1,000 years ago to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. In fact, a small drop in temperatures as we headed into what was known as the Little Ice Age of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, followed by an unprecedented spike, which is the spike of modern global warming, that takes us outside of the range of the variation that was evident as far back as we could go, 1,000 years. And it sort of looks like a hockey stick, where the blade is the modern warming spike that indeed is unprecedented as far back as we or others have been able to take these sorts of estimates. Because of the appearance of the graph, it got called the hockey stick. It became an icon in the climate change debate, an iconic sort of entity in the climate change debate because it told a simple story. You didn't need to understand the complex workings of Earth's climate to understand what this curve was telling us, that there is this unprecedented warming of the planet that has taken place over the last century and a half. And by inference, it probably has to do with human activity. And in fact, we know that we cannot explain that warming without the effect of increasing greenhouse gas concentrations. So I think because it became a symbol, an easy to understand symbol that really conveyed in a very understandable way the profound nature of the changes that we are causing in the climate of our planet, it became a target for the critics, those who don't want to believe in the scientific evidence, fossil fuel interests and the various groups that they fund who have been doing their best to try to discredit the science of climate change because they don't want to see any regulation of carbon emissions. The hockey stick curve became a focal point of their attacks and their critiques. And I found myself as a young scientist who never had any interest in being in the fray on the larger contentious political issue of climate change and what to do about it, I found myself at the center of that debate. And ultimately, I chose to embrace the opportunity that provided me to inform the dialogue about this very important problem. But it isn't what I signed up for when I first started out in science.
Well, thank you so much for being with us again. Dr. Michael Mann, it's great to have you back with us.
It's always great to be with you. Thank you.
Professor Michael Mann is a climatologist and geophysicist, and he's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University. Dr. Mann was one of the lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and has written a book called The Madhouse Effect. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.